It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Support for this podcast comes from U.S. Bank. When it's time for a new credit card, the best ones do way more than just buy stuff. And that's why U.S. Bank offers credit cards that make every day more rewarding. Earn cash back, score points when you shop, dine out, travel, or binge watch, or get a low intro APR. U.S. Bank credit cards were designed to fit your lifestyle. So make every day more rewarding and check out usbank.com/creditcard. U.S. Bank credit cards are issued by U.S. Bank National Association N.D. Some restrictions may apply. Member FDIC.
They're going to kill the love of my life.
Jason!
If I don't go back to what I was doing.
This Friday.
Our line of work is quite brutal and quite ruthless.
How far would you go for love?
You steal truck, bring it to me. Then you make your money.
Is it dangerous?
Of course it's dangerous!
Nicholas Holt, Felicity Jones, with Ben Kingsley and Anthony Hopkins.
All this trouble, all this pain, for love.
Collide, in theaters Friday. Rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Welcome to the RotoWire Fantasy Football Podcast, sponsored by Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over. Derek Van Riper here with Mike Doria. Got a great episode lined up. We're going to talk about Mike's draft from the online championship. The RotoWire Online Championship is part of the NFFC 12-team contest we're running in conjunction with the good folks over there. So we're going to get Mike's team. We're going to get some thoughts on how his draft went down. We'll talk a little bit about the way that league is structured. We're going to talk about that in detail, actually, on the Friday episode with Vlad Sedler. We'll talk about the main event, some of the other stuff the NFFC does. So it kind of ties in nicely to what we've got on tap for tomorrow. If you listen to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, you could please leave us a review. We'd greatly appreciate that. Mike, let's start by diving into some top news before we start looking at your team. Devin Funchess, arguably the Panthers' most impressive performer during training camp. This according to ESPN's David Newton. Are you concerned that as a result of Funchess being there in year two and looking good, that Kelvin Benjamin may fall short of the numbers he posted as a rookie? Because the expectation for many people is that Benjamin can come back and just do what he did that year, if not more, coming off a torn ACL, but I don't really know where those targets are going to come from. And Jericho Cotri's gone. Ted Ginn will probably get less. Maybe they scale back Greg Olsen a little, but there's a lot of targets that Kelvin Benjamin piled up 2 years ago that may not be there in 2016.
Well, I mean, Funchess is a guy that was hyped a little bit last year, and I guess he wasn't quite ready for it at that stage. But I think at this stage of his development, he's certainly ready to take the next step forward. I think that he's definitely a nice dart in mid to later rounds. That's probably where he's going at this stage. I'm not necessarily targeting him aggressively, but if he falls and it starts getting into, for lack of a better player to make fun of, Eddie Royal territory or something like that, I'm obviously going to take Funchess over a mediocre veteran. But as it relates to Kelvin Benjamin, there's this new assumption that people, players, can just bounce back from the ACL injuries seamlessly. And while some have, it's not necessarily a given. Now, in the case of Benjamin, There's been talk that in training camp he's been battling with some conditioning issues. I wouldn't overreact to that, but it's a little bit of a red flag. And generally speaking, especially at this time of the year, until I've seen these guys that are coming off the serious injuries actually do some stuff against top competition, I'm a little bit hesitant. And I mean, it is reflected in all the drafts that I've done to date. And Kelvin Benjamin is not a guy that I was targeting in any of my drafts up till now, because he's been going in a slot that you would normally place a player who has no health concerns, not coming back from anything bad. So, I mean, he could come back just fine, but there's enough of a worry for me there to not go after him.
The current ADP, if you're looking at the NFFC, is 33 overall. I mean, that's a late third-round pick in a 12-team league, kind of a mid-third-round pick if you're in a 14-teamer. I'd rather have Jeremy Maclin, who's going a couple picks later. I'd rather have Doug Baldwin. I think I'd rather have him too, to be honest. So it is kind of near where the tier break is at wide receiver for me, but at the same time, there's enough there where I'm not paying the current price to get Kelvin Benjamin, and Devin Funchess is part of the reason why. But I do think there are limitations with what Funchess could do as a result of how that offense is built. I don't really see Carolina coming out this year and throwing it 600 times instead of 500 times. Maybe right. We'll see a slight increase in attempts from Cam Newton, but if anything, it'd be 525, 530. It'd be a handful of attempts per game of an increase, as opposed to, hey, 8 to 10 more attempts per game. They're not going to completely change the look of that offense unless Jonathan Stewart gets hurt. If Jonathan Stewart goes down, I don't know if I like any of the backup running backs there enough to look at them as a team that will run it as much as they have in the past.
Yeah, there's some like deep league excitement about Cameron Artis Payne, Jonathan Stewart, yeah, he's a guy that just seems to get injured all the time. Right now, that doesn't seem to be a problem. He is coming back from some issues, last year and early on, in the off season. But Jonathan Stewart's a guy that's actually been falling to a kind of soft spot in drafts where people are just writing him off. He's kind of the only show in town and has been since D'Angelo Williams left. Unless, of course, you're an Artis Payne believer, but I think they have a level of trust in Stewart that he's going to get a decent amount of carries as long as he can handle them in a team that likes to run a lot, and that includes the quarterback.
Yeah, I mean, I would think Jonathan Stewart with health gets over 220 carries this season. I mean, he's going to be heavily worked because Cameron Artis Payne hasn't shown a lot. I mean, they've really just Fozzie Whitaker still there, Tolbert still hanging around. Like, they just don't have anything of interest right now forcing the issue in that backfield. Let's move on to the Chiefs. Jamaal Charles made it through a complete practice Thursday. He's not going to play Saturday in the Chiefs' second preseason game. ADP has been pretty strong on Charles all along. He's coming off his second career ACL tear. There is this belief, too, that with ACLs, for a player who's gone through the recovery process before, that they have a good understanding of what kind of rehab they're up against, and as a result, they know how they can push themselves. So maybe in some ways a second tear has led people to have more confidence in Charles than if he'd just torn it for the first time. Are you taking him late part of round two, early part of round three, where he's been going? Because he's pretty consistently right there around pick 25.
That seems about right for me. I still tend to veer away from the ACL guys until I see something. I mean, he's, as you mentioned, he's not playing in the second week of the preseason. I don't know if we're actually going to see him in the preseason. And if so, I'm sure it's going to be a very small sample size. The one thing to draw on is that, yes, this is not his first ACL tear that he's coming back from. And though I don't have the numbers in front of me, I believe that he's one of the players that was exceptional in his return from his first ACL. So he's got that history of coming back well from it. But again, every serious knee injury is different. It's not going to the level of damage. We can't presume it to be identical or anything like that. He's a little bit older. The team has signed his backups to decent contracts. So even if he is back up to speed, I would imagine that they're going to do some things to maybe reduce his workload, to maintain his health throughout the season, keep him fresh. So he's a guy that I'm not targeting. If he falls to a certain level where I'm looking at running backs that I I just think are in committees or don't like their upside, then I'm starting to look at Jamaal Charles as a guy I'm going to target. But like, definitely, sometimes it's to my detriment, but I really avoid players coming back from serious injuries until they pass the eye test for me.
I generally do that too. I mean, I haven't picked up Jordy Nelson outside of a best ball league, and even then, I took more receivers after him than I would have otherwise because I'm not completely sure he's going to be the guy we saw before he got hurt, at least in the beginning part of the season. Maybe by the end of the year, he'll start to regain that form, but it may take him some time, especially with the time he missed during training camp.
And you've probably read every word written about Jordy Nelson since his injury as a Packers guy, but like some of the teams, you just don't hear that much about these guys. Le'Veon Bell, he also has the suspension looming, but like his knee recovery was not going, the way that a lot of people expected. And we just weren't getting a lot of details from the Steelers, which is typical. I mean, the Patriots are famous for not being forthcoming with injury reports, but the Steelers are another team that they don't talk about stuff unless they have to. And so it's just the different levels of information that come out about these players, that can factor in as well.
Let's move on to the Broncos quarterback situation. Trevor Siemian has been taking the first team reps in practice this week. It's going to start the second preseason game. To me, this doesn't even seem real. I keep thinking Mark Sanchez is going to be the guy, but they pretty clearly see something in Denver in Trevor Siemian that we just don't really get a chance to see because a lot of it's happening in practice. And they kind of showed us last year they didn't need to have quality play at quarterback to win a Super Bowl.
Yeah.
But this seems like they're really, really kind of pushing the envelope this year as far as how they've handled the position. Paxton Lynch not quite being ready, and then Siemian really just battling Mark Sanchez for the job. Do you believe the Broncos are actually considering Trevor Siemian as their week one starter?
I suppose they are. I don't think that's going to be the outcome, but I think they do need to sort of prep him in case Sanchez gets hurt. I do think that they're going to hand the keys to Sanchez, but they're both just kind of keeping the bench warm for Paxton Lynch, as he said. And rather than go out and get a guy that with upside or a veteran that might get locked into the job, it seems like they've thrown kind of a journeyman veteran and a rookie, or not a rookie, but a guy that was like a late round draft pick, pretty unheralded. I mean, even Osweiler was a second rounder, and I believe Siemian was a seventh round pick. So, there's not a whole lot of investment there, in those guys, and they're just going to use the same formula: adequate quarterback play supported by solid run and strong defense. And then it wouldn't surprise me if Lynch, started getting starts toward the end of the season. I don't know if he's going to get a full red shirt year.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think by week 9, week 10, we could see Paxton Lynch working his way into the starting lineup in Denver. Also from the confusing news items folder, Daryl Bevel, Seahawks offensive coordinator, who confuses me all the time, I think he's just messing with us, suggesting that Kristen Michael and Thomas Rawls could actually work in some kind of timeshare. Like, that to me just floors me, because Kristen Michael in previous opportunities with Seattle really didn't impress. Like, always had the physical tools that were intriguing, but never seemed to be the player they thought they had. And this time around, by all accounts, things are different. You got Rawls coming off the ankle injury. Is this more of just Bevel kind of making it seem as though Michael has a path to a significant role to begin the season, or do you see them becoming a team that leans more on two running backs?
Well, you turn back the clock. Once upon a time, the Seahawks really liked Kristen Michael. Wasn't he a second-round pick?
He was.
And then whatever happened. He just, Lynch kept on being Lynch, and Michael did not develop at the rate that they wanted him to. Turbin was still around. And they eventually, they cut him. They cut bait with him. So it's kind of surprising that, in his second turn with the team, that he's now being looked at in so much higher regard. But yeah, I mean, from all accounts, he's improved, preparation wise and things of that nature. But there's one thing that you didn't mention there, and it's that the Seahawks drafted 3 running backs this spring, and so on the one hand, that kind of signals that they may not have been completely sold on Rawls to begin with. Maybe it was that there was concern over the injury that they weren't articulating at the time. But I think that they're open to new methods there now that they can't just hand the ball to Lynch until he falls down.
Maybe even Seattle was surprised by what Thomas Rawls did last year. I mean, in all reality, they probably weren't expecting more than 5 yards a carry from anybody other than maybe Marshawn Lynch.
Yeah, well, I think going into the preseason, Michael was, once again considered maybe the favorite to take that number two role. But quickly, things changed. Rawls looked good. And then, all the things that happened that led to him having an opportunity last year, and while he didn't exactly duplicate Marshawn Lynch production and style of running, he was a good fit for the Seattle offense when healthy. But again, they drafted three running backs, so it's clearly a position that they're in transition with right now.
Yeah, could give you some pause as far as taking Thomas Rawls in the top 55, 60 picks or so. It's typically where I've seen him go over the last few weeks. One more item from the WTF folder. Do you view Gronk and Martellus Bennett as interchangeable? I saw an article from Mike Reese, longtime Patriots beat writer, covers the team now for ESPN. Do you think it's really like that, where Bennett's going to somehow eat into Gronk's production, or do you see it just being a case where scheme-wise, they're going two tight ends, and because they have a lot of injuries right now at receiver, Bennett's just going to help pick up the slack?
Well, the interchangeable thing is not necessarily that they're the exact same player, but they do have some similar basic traits. Big, can get open, can run after the catch, can block, things like that. And they're both very dangerous in the red zone. So, I mean, Martellus Bennett becomes a fantasy star if anything happens to Gronkowski. I think Gronkowski may lose the odd red zone look there with Bennett in the mix. But I don't think it's enough to take him away from the top tier that is his own in the tight end category. Bennett is a good complementary tight end as long as in fantasy, as long as Gronkowski is healthy and then suddenly vaults, to elite status if anything happens to Gronkowski. Back when the Patriots were running the two tight end sets with Gronk and Aaron Hernandez, that was a mismatch and a headache for defensive coordinators. And I think they're kind of, even though Bennett's not that type of player necessarily, they're just trying to go for something that's going to be very difficult to defend against. I wouldn't say that their wideout core is mediocre, but it's not a whole lot of size there. With some of their guys, Chris Hogan's the newcomer from who they signed away from Buffalo. I believe he's a 6'1 or 6'2, and he's got some size. But generally, it's guys like Edelman and Amendola running around, and maybe Malcolm Mitchell. So it's just good to have those two hulking targets that can do damage in the middle of the field in the end zone.
I guess I've been looking at it where I could see Bennett maybe taking away a few red zone targets from a guy like Julian Edelman. He could be the one that loses out on some opportunities in close, because Gronk and Bennett should be on the field together, especially when they're in close. They're going to be on the field a lot anyway. At the same time, I saw in that Reese article, they suggested as much as 80% of the time, the Patriots may roll out a two tight end set. So with that, I think Bennett can be a useful, a low-end tight end one, kind of a high-end tight end two sort of player, even if Gronk is healthy, as you suggested. Nobody ever gets in their car thinking, I'm drunk, I'm driving, and I'm going to kill someone tonight. They might think, I've had a few drinks, but I'm okay to drive, or I live a few minutes from here, or I've gotten away with this plenty of times before. And they think like that right up until the moment they kill someone. Thousands of people are killed in drunk driving crashes every year. It's better to be safe than sorry. Download the free Safer Ride app to help you call a taxi or send a friend your location when you've been drinking. Drive sober or get pulled over. Now it's time for our safe sleeper pick, sponsored by Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over. Many of us will be downing beers at our fantasy football drafts, which leads to bad decisions in the later rounds, or worse decisions like getting behind the wheel after the draft. Today's safe sleeper pick, Mike, it's Rishard Matthews, the ADP 153 right now in the NFFC. And with Doriel Green Beckham gone, things are a lot less crowded in Tennessee. This is a player they plucked intentionally from Miami in free agency. If you buy into Marcus Mariota at all as a quarterback who can improve in year two, someone has to reap the benefits behind Delanie Walker. I think Delanie Walker is going to get his from the tight end spot, but to me, it's not Kendall Wright. It's a guy like Matthews who's much more explosive.
Yeah, if you look at the receiving stats last year for the Titans, I think that whatever Matthews did in Miami would have he would have led the Titans. And Delanie Walker, as a tight end, I believe, led the team in receiving there. And so, yeah, there is some upside there. They cleared a little bit of a path by getting rid of Green Beckham. I mean, obviously, that's a team that, you know, between a mobile quarterback and then, like, you know, two very talented running backs, it seems like they're going to, you know, pound the ball a lot. And there's some term that's out there on the internet, exotic smash mouth football. So, you know, like, I don't think that there's a huge upside in the Tennessee, you know, passing game outside of maybe Walker. But like you said, somebody's got to be the number one wideout. Someone, you know, someone's going to be the top target. Someone's going to be the number two wideout target. And in a PPR league or just, you know, if you're looking for depth at wideout, you go to guys that are on the field more often than not for your bottom end production there.
10.9 yards per target last season for Rishard Matthews in Miami. Caught 43 passes, 10 went for 20 or more yards, 4 went for 40 or more yards. So you can certainly see him getting behind DBs and making some big plays in year one in Tennessee. That's something they really didn't have in that offense last year either. All right, so we're going to dive into Mike's RotoWire Online Fantasy Football Championship draft. This went down about a week or so ago, right? This is last week?
Last Wednesday night. So about a week. And I would say about the only thing that context-wise that's changed significantly is that Ladarius Green has suddenly gone from a guy, you know, destined to replace Heath Miller, you know, bouncing back from an ankle injury but expected to be fine, to like this shroud of mystery around him now that there's talk that he might be dealing with lingering headaches. And again, the Steelers aren't really opening up about that, but he's still on PUP, and it's time to start thinking about Jesse James a little bit. But yeah, other than that, I would say this draft would probably play out roughly the same if it were to take place today.
Yeah, I don't think Green would have much of a butterfly effect on the overall draft board, even though there is significantly less interest now than there was a week ago, given what we know now about where he's at health-wise. Now, you ended up with the third overall pick, and in all NFFC leagues, you have what's called Kentucky Derby style draft spot selection, where you rank all the different draft positions 1 through 12 in the order of preference. The system randomly draws a team, and then you get the highest available remaining preference on your list. The other wrinkle, of course, the full point PPR, but there's also a third round reversal. So the team that picks first in round two also picks first in round three, and then from there it goes through the typical snake draft order. So everything is a little bit off when you look at the results grids. Just, you got to realize that three is going from right to left instead of from left to right as you read a grid like that. So how did you rank your draft slot preferences for the 12-team format, accounting for the way the NFFC typically plays?
Yeah, obviously it's a little bit different every year, but it is kind of a fun exercise to like look at it and, you know, come up with like a distinct first round tier. And I definitely, you know, looked at it and thought, well, I'd be very happy with one of the top four picks. And then after that, if I didn't get one of the top four picks, then it'd be kind of cool to be at the back end of the order and take advantage of that reversal. So I don't exactly remember my order now that I put in, but I think I did 1, 3, 2, 4, and then 12.
And then kind of worked back from 12 up to 5?
Yeah, because I thought, I mean, the only no-brainer for me probably would have been Antonio Brown at 1. And then after that, at 2 or 3, you know, I was either going to go with Beckham or Gurley. Julio Jones, if I landed the number 4 pick, that would have been a no-brainer for me. So after that, though, that's when I would have paused and you know, started either maybe reaching for a Ezekiel Elliott or, you know, David Johnson might be a conventional pick there too. But it became less obvious to me after 4 who I would pick. So that's, I loaded it up with the top 4, and then after that went immediately for the later picks in my request list.
Yeah, so I typically would probably set up my KDS the same way in terms of my preferences, going kind of, I'd probably go 4-1 working backwards all the way through, but going 1, 3, 2, 4, something along those lines, not really a big difference for me as far as how that is ultimately going to play out. In part, though, because I want to be a little earlier in the order in rounds 2 and 3. So that's why my preference to be 4 over 1 actually is something I would consider to be sort of a toss-up. But you went Gurley over Julio, and I think if you look at most NFFC draft boards because of the full point PPR, the three receivers, Brown, Beckham, and Jones, go in those first three spots. Then we see Gurley typically go at number four. Why Gurley over Julio in this format?
I mean, it was kind of a close call, but I just decided that, you know, one of my strategies, generally speaking, in this sort of draft is to try to have elite and top options at least a couple of positions, if not more. And I just felt like this year's running back class, there was not a whole lot, you know, if I didn't take Gurley in that slot, I was probably going to end up with my top running back being somebody I had issues with. So, yeah, Julio Jones would have been a great pick. But I just wanted to get that, like, running back who I think is this year's, you know, home run pick. It's a little bit on the obvious side, but, you know, Gurley, you know, a top draft pick last year. He was coming back from a serious injury. He did well enough in his time, you know, with the Rams last year. And I just think that he's in an offense where it's going to have to run through him. I mean, they're either going to go with a sort of, you know, mediocre quarterback that's been floating around for a while or an unproven rookie. I mean, eventually the rookie's going to get the job. But I just think that that's going to be a run-heavy team. And if you look at the depth chart there, I mean, Benny Cunningham is kind of a, you know, profiles as a change of pace, pass-catching kind of guy. But, like, they're just going to have to give the ball to Gurley tons. And, you know, now that he's further past that injury, I think he's got the fresh legs and he's always had the talent. So I just see him as the kind of guy that you really aggressively target, kind of as we did when Adrian Peterson was in his prime.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of similarities in the sense that the Rams will use Gurley in a way very similar to how the Vikings did use Peterson, the way that roster, that offense is constructed. Very similar to a lot of the Minnesota offenses we've seen over the years, with AP really being the focal point, with less than stellar quarterback play, and with receivers that maybe leave quite a bit to be desired. So certainly I see the case for it. And then how it comes together is all important as far as, you know, what happens to your receiver if you don't take one in round one. And I think as we'll see, that's probably your greatest position of need, either in that you'll need a couple guys that you targeted as your wide receivers 2 and 3 to really step up, or you'll have to cash into the waiver wire when something big happens, some surprise emerges. You're going to have to be the guy that goes out, breaks the fab piggy bank, and reels that player in. But you started with Gurley. You got Jeffrey in round 2, Doug Martin in round 3. So two backs in the first 3 picks. It's a great spot to be in that you don't have to worry about the running back position each and every week. You've got the flexibility to cycle through your receivers and your flex options for the other spot. And getting depth at running back is kind of easy. Getting, you know, quality options in the middle rounds, if you wait, has proven to be a little bit difficult in some of the drafts I've done. You went quarterback pretty early in this one. You know, after Gurley, Jeffrey, and Martin, you got Aaron Rodgers in round 4. That was coming back through the 39th overall pick. Have you had success going quarterbacks early in high stakes leagues like this in the past?
Typically, no. I don't jump on the quarterbacks even that early. I looked at my NFC draft last year, and the first 2 quarterbacks were Luck and Rodgers taken in round 2. So in last year's draft, there was opponents of mine that were, you know, more aggressively seeking out the quarterbacks. And in this case, I was definitely not targeting Rodgers with that pick. And that was very much a product of my draft board. If you look at it closely, the 3 picks before the Rodgers picks were wideouts. And that was essentially my draft board. So I was kind of like looking at taking one of those players, one of those wideouts. And I kind of got stuck in the position where, like, now I'm looking at about 5 wideouts that I think are kind of all roughly the same, or a chance to have the choice of any quarterback in the draft and create, you know, that situation I was talking about before, like where I have, if not the top, one of the very top players at a position. So though it wasn't my strategy, the flow of the draft led me to that pick. And I strongly considered Cam Newton as well, but I just felt like, you know, health-wise, composition of the offense-wise, that Aaron Rodgers would be the pick for me there.
Yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense because Dante Moncrief, Jeremy Maclin, Eric Decker, all guys you probably would have considered if they were still available going in those first three picks right before you. But that first team started off with four consecutive receivers, which when you start three in a flex could make a lot of sense. I actually like that foundation, Brown, Watkins, Moncrief, and Maclin. But the question is, when you do that, can you find the right running backs to fill in over the course of the season? So you get Rodgers, you lock him in. You got Travis Kelce in round five. And to me, there's a big tier break after Travis Kelce. You're either going to invest early in tight end with one of Gronk, Olsen, or Kelce. Some people like Jordan Reed. I've talked a lot about my concerns with the concussions he's dealt with over his career. He's been a very banged up player throughout his time in Washington. So I stay away from Jordan Reed at his current price. But to get Travis Kelce late in round five seems like tremendous value because he's the kind of guy that can score from anywhere on the field. He has breakaway speed that's rare for the tight end position. And I think for him to ever get double-digit touchdowns, he needs that because the Chiefs are not a team that want Alex Smith throwing the ball often in the red zone. And I think that's the thing that can hold Kelce back at times. But the yardage, the TDs, to me, there's still one more level there because of what Kelce brings to the table.
Yeah, I was pretty happy with that pick. And I think by the middle of that round, I was hoping that he would fall to me just because obviously if you don't get Gronkowski and he went in the second round with the seventh pick in the second round of this draft, then you're looking at, as you said, Jordan Reed, who for the same reason that you stated, while I'm not going to necessarily not draft him, I'm not targeting him as high as he tends to go or pay as much for him as you need to pay in auctions. I mean, he's coming off a great year, obviously, but yeah, definitely worried about his injury history. And then after that, there is like a second tier that like includes Greg Olsen, Kelce. You could maybe argue on Colby Fleener, even Delanie Walker. But I out of that tier, I liked Kelce just slightly more than any of those other options. A little bit more proven, established. Pretty solid rapport last year with Alex Smith. There's not a whole lot going on pass catching wise in terms of the receivers and fellow tight ends other than Maclin there. So there's pretty nice floor for both Maclin and Kelce, and I like that. If you're like throwing the upside dart, you might just want to say, hey, Colby Fleener, he's going to catch passes from Drew Brees, who kind of made Ben Watson a star last year. But yeah, I think that Kelce was a good pick there. And tight end is definitely, I guess in a 12 team league, it's not quite as barren, but if you're in a 14 or 16 team league, I think that you really need to, be very, careful not to end up with, the 10th, 11th, 12th best tight end, because you're just going to have a headache at that position all year long.
I feel like that's generally the case unless it's Gary Barnage. Like Gary Barnage, to me, people should buy into what this guy did last year, because even with Corey Coleman there and Josh Gordon back, it's going to be a better offense as a whole. And I think you might see the yardage come down, but I think the TD output could still be there pretty consistently from Gary Barnage.
It's possible, but he came out of nowhere. That was definitely a rags to riches story fantasy wise. A lot of his context has changed. He could end up being the stable force, the last bastion of the 2015 Browns passing offense. But I don't mind Gary Barnage, but I don't trust him to repeat that. New quarterback, essentially new wideouts surrounding him. Their backfield isn't like awesome, but I think that they complement each other relatively well. Carell and Duke Johnson. I don't mind Gary Barnage as like a very good tight end backup, but I'd rather go with someone a little bit more upside, proven upside than him right now as my starter.
That's what the market seems to think of him too. I seem to be the high man in the room on Gary Barnage most of the time. I mentioned the receiving core maybe being the weakness, and of course if you go running back, receiver, but then running back, quarterback, tight end, you are chasing receivers later. You get your second one with Marvin Jones in round six and your third later with Vincent Jackson in the eighth. And with Marvin Jones, I mean, he was behind AJ Green, missed a year with an injury in Cincinnati, and there's been some buzz that Jones has looked like the Lions' number one receiver during camp. I don't know if that's necessarily going to hold up in terms of Jones getting more targets than Golden Tate. But if you think the Lions are going to continue to sling it as often as they have in these last couple seasons and as effectively as they did last year once they made the change at offensive coordinator, I mean, Marvin Jones should be pretty stable as a guy you get in round six of these drafts.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, I think that Golden Tate's role is going to remain somewhat stable, and they basically had to figure out a way to replace Calvin Johnson. And I'm not suggesting that Marvin Jones is a one-to-one replacement there. That's going to be kind of a committee thing. You know, they're hoping for improvement from tight end Eric Ebron. They brought in Anquan Boldin, but I remember being impressed with Marvin Jones the year that he scored 10 touchdowns, and he's got size, decent red zone presence there. And I just think that he's going to produce in that offense. I believe that Boldin had already signed with the Lions by the time this draft rolled around, and that slightly tempered my enthusiasm. But before that, I was extremely high on Jones. I think that's going to end up being one of the better bangs for the free agent buck in this year's crop of free agents. When we look at the investments that teams made, I think that the Lions made a good one there, and some of the other teams might regret some of the overpayments they made in free agency. But I think it's a good fit, and I think he's ready to bounce back and put up the kind of numbers that he did in his finest year with the Bengals.
Now, looking a little further down at how this came together, Frank Gore in the seventh, kind of the flex or third running back for you, depending on how things shake out with the rest of your roster. What's your best case scenario with Frank Gore? I mean, is it that he could be a steady RB2 for you if one of your other guys goes down, or do you see him more as just a flex guy that you like because with a healthy Andrew Luck, the Colts should spend significantly more time in the red zone this year?
Yeah, definitely. I wasn't, picturing him as my number two back. Obviously, you point out the fact that something could happen to Gurley or Martin, and then I would be forced to consider that. But I like having a running back, or at least an option of a running back who's going to get consistent touches as a flex play early on. And a couple rounds later, I picked Derrick Henry, and I feel like maybe Derrick Henry might not be worthy of a lineup slot early on, but by midseason, he could be my either RB2 or my flex play. And Gore is kind of an early season, somewhat boring, but at least steady placeholder for that flex spot. And then, as you pointed out, my wideout core is not exactly brimming, so I've got a couple wideouts that I feel good about starting, and I'm basically just going to patch together a wideout core. You know, hopefully Vincent Jackson, is adequate as my third wideout, and then just be very aggressive in free agency when outliers that didn't get drafted. With the draft this early, there's going to be some guys in the free agent pool at every position, but notably wideout, that are going to be, you know, ready to be bid on and inserted in the lineup in week one.
I mean, Jackson's part of what should be a very productive Tampa Bay passing game, and a lot of people like Mike Evans as a top 15, top 20 overall type player, but Jackson should benefit from Evans drawing more of the attention as far as their pass catchers go. Chris Hogan was your 11th round pick, kind of comes in at your number four receiver spot. How has he meshed so far in New England? I mean, you cover the Patriots for the site, aside from being like the day-to-day football editor, knowing everything about the news and what's going on around the league. What's the buzz been about Chris Hogan thus far this preseason?
Well, he used to have the nickname 7-11 because he was always open. And, he's kind of living up to that billing, you know, that there's been some positive buzz about him in training camp. I think at worst, he's what Brandon LaFell was the first year that Brandon LaFell was with the Patriots, and was probably in fantasy, you could say, in most situations, a pretty solid, number three wideout. So I think that's probably his floor. I mean, a lot depends on Julian Edelman, the targets that he gets. I'm not saying that Hogan would be the direct backup to Julian Edelman. Danny Amendola is still around to kind of serve in that role. They drafted Malcolm Mitchell. There's talk that he's, definitely in their long-term plans. But I think Chris Hogan is just the, other than Julian Edelman, I think that he probably has the steadiest path to targets at the Patriots offense among the receivers. So I just felt that, you know, at that stage of the draft, if anything happens to Edelman, Hogan would benefit from extra targets. And even if Edelman is fine, Hogan's a pretty solid, in my opinion, number four fantasy receiver with upside for more.
I've been targeting him in best ball formats right now because I think it may be difficult to know when exactly his role is going to increase. It may take a few weeks into the season before he's really productive. May even take the eventual return of Tom Brady to get Chris Hogan up to that wide receiver three level that you mentioned. I mean, I like him as a player that New England kind of sought out quietly in free agency from Buffalo. As I've mentioned many times, he's a converted lacrosse player. He was not even a full-time football player during his time in college.
Yeah, he's a good athlete, well-conditioned, knows how to get open. I mean, there was definitely things, you know, about his makeup that the Patriots liked, and I think he's a good fit. I mean, Brandon LaFell was a good fit, too, but he then proceeded to get hurt last year, and, you know, they moved on rather quickly. But, you know, they need that sort of bigger, stronger wideout option to go along with Edelman and Amendola types, for
yeah,
sure.
It makes sense based on the personnel that they currently have around him. They would seek him out, especially given the price, low price in free agency, kind of like Marvin Jones, as far as being in the running for a player that could end up being one of the better free agent signings. Jones cost a lot more than Hogan did, but the Patriots generally are pretty smart with moves like this. Do you enjoy playing fantasy football for cash but are tired of the same game offerings or hosting sites keeping too much of the prize pool? If so, check out MaximumFantasySports.com. They offer a variety of season-long and DFS fantasy football leagues with features no other website has, and they pay out 90% of the prize pool. Does your state prevent you from playing in a DFS league and you're not interested in a full season league? MFS runs monthly fantasy football leagues known as a four-week frenzy league, and those are available to you. Forget salary cap leagues and use the online draft for all of your full season and short-term leagues at MaximumFantasySports.com. If private leagues interest you, register your own redraft and keeper leagues using options like in-game player changes, multi-team trades, team quarterbacks, bye week rollover, and more. You can even run your survivor pools, confidence pools, pick'em pools, and squares pools for free at MaximumFantasySports.com. Join today. A couple other questions pertaining to your draft, Mike, before we sign off. We talked about the draft position already and staying away from 5, 6, 7, and 8 if possible. I mean, if you had to pick somebody in that range, DeAndre Hopkins, Allen Robinson, AJ Green, David Johnson, Le'Veon Bell, Zeke Elliott, I mean, which player would you most want if you're in that middle part of round one?
Yeah, like we were talking about earlier, around five is where it starts getting a little bit, I wouldn't say dicey, but it's just not as clear cut as maybe the top four are. And that's, I think the conventional wisdom might be David Johnson in a lot of formats. In this particular draft, DeAndre Hopkins went number five. But I might have maybe tried to go for the Todd Gurley light approach with Ezekiel Elliott. Le'Veon Bell, especially in this format, is fantastic, but he's got the looming suspension. Yeah, we're still not sure that that's actually going to go through, but you put that on top of the knee injury, and you know, he suddenly falls a little bit. Yeah, I like the fresh legs of Ezekiel Elliott, David Johnson, and then after that, you know, there's the tier two receivers. They're all excellent. I mean, you got Hopkins, Allen Robinson, Dez Bryant, Mike Evans, Brandon Cooks. But I have a hard time sorting that order out quickly. So therefore, I'd be happy with one of those guys at the very end of the first round rather than having to determine which one is the best option at number five or six.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I think if I had to make the call, David Johnson probably would be the first choice from that bunch, but Allen Robinson would be my first choice from the receivers right after him, because I think what he could do in Jacksonville this year could be very, very good again, especially, I mean, the big play volume is probably coming down, but if he's making fewer big plays and they're still moving the chains, he might catch more passes in PPR. That helps offset some of the yardage difference. So I look at Allen Robinson as a pretty special player.
They should have a pretty solid running attack this year, overall more balanced offense. So that's generally good, but I think last year he you know, they really focused on him and Alan Hearns a lot. And I think there's going to be a little bit more balance there. So that might impact him a little bit. Not too much, but he's definitely infinitely more valuable than he was this time last year when people were kind of like, who do you like better, Allen Robinson or Marquise Lee?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's hard to believe that was ever really a conversation, but maybe a reason to think about Marquise Lee as sort of a lottery ticket now that he's finally healthy. I will go rapid fire on these last few questions. They're all related to running backs because if you go receiver heavy early, you're going to have to backfill Arian Foster early in round 5 in your draft. It's as early as I've seen Arian Foster go this draft season. Do you think he will be productive enough to warrant that price tag?
I do. And when this draft happened, he had not been, the ink was barely dry on his contract with Dolphins. I mean, that's maybe a slight exaggeration, but I do think that as long as he stays healthy for the rest of the summer and approaching week one, you know, you said a 5th round price tag for him. That looks pretty good. I think in this draft, it was a little bit aggressive and speculative, but I think that he's looked good enough in the preseason. And it's clear, or at least in training camp, it's clear that the Dolphins were not entirely comfortable with Ajay to begin with. They drafted a running back and then they went out and got Foster. So I think that he does have the opportunity to seize that top role as long as he can reprove his health. And we all know what he can do when he's healthy. So yeah, why not? I mean, if he was pre-Achilles, you know, you're looking at, you know, a top 10 pick there.
Yeah, that's the type of per-game production we've seen from Arian Foster for a long time. Isaiah Crowell in round 6, drunk owner, or is there something there?
Well, I don't mind Isaiah Crowell, but yeah, I think that is a little bit, it's a little bit jumping the gun there, especially in a, you know, PPR format. I mean, Duke Johnson is going to kind of serve that role for the Browns. Looking at who went behind him, you know, D'Angelo Williams might get, you know, 4 starts out of the gate. Charles Sims, you know, pass catcher out of the Bucs' backfield. Abdullah, Jeremy Hill. I mean, I it's hard for me to justify taking him over, you know, Jeremy Hill if you're looking for that sort of bigger, you know, non-PPR type back. So, yeah, Not a bad player, but I think, you know, too high given what was available behind him.
I mean, do you believe, looking at Melvin Gordon, who went in round 8, do you believe in a Melvin Gordon bounce back this year? Run blocking was a big problem for the Chargers a year ago. Gordon and Denny Woodhead both struggled as ball carriers. It seems like Melvin Gordon has the talent to be productive in the NFL, but if the line play is still bad, is it worth taking that flyer right now on Melvin Gordon in round 8 if that ends up being the price in other drafts?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think that's a really nice slot for him. Whoever drafted him has a very nice lottery ticket there. I mean, basically, Melvin Gordon heading into last year where he was drafted by the Chargers, you know, after the production he enjoyed at Wisconsin in college, just looked like a sure thing and, you know, didn't find the end zone. And then the main concern for me and everyone else, obviously, occurred the day that I wrote a Melvin Gordon player update on RotoWire, which included the word microfracture. So microfracture is not necessarily, you know, a career killer, but it's definitely something that you can't dismiss or, you know, just assume that everything's going to be fine. Because I'm not a doctor, and on the RotoWire MD cheat sheet, I'm probably not even top 10. But I do know that there's different levels of severity, and, you know, microfracture can be extremely complicated and, you know, almost like a last resort for some players, and other ones it's just kind of a, you know, improve the healing process type thing. So, you know, at his age, his mileage, and the way that he seems to be performing in training camp, it seems like his knee is fairly sound. But I'm not, you know, he's not question free, but there is the upside, obviously.
Yeah, I like him at that price. I mean, microfracture, there's a wide range of procedures that fall under that. It's a way that surgery is performed, so the severity of what's being repaired can vary quite a bit from player to player.
It's like root canal surgery. It was like some people, you say root canal and you just think the worst thing ever. And other people are like, it's a piece of cake.
They just shrug it off. Yeah. They've had multiple root canals, so they don't think it's a big deal, I guess. All right. Well, that's going to wrap things up for today's episode of the RotoWire Fantasy Football Podcast, sponsored by Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over. For Mike Doria, I'm Derek Van Riper. Vlad and I are back with you on Friday.
Knows that by the foot, there's no better ride than an old station wagon. Room for six people facing forward, two people facing backward, and a whole lot of luggage, lumber, and bicycles haphazardly strapped to the roof. If you can parallel park that beast, you can park anything. And with some quality parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep your land ship running longer, stronger. It's not obsolete. It's a rare treasure. That's Napa know-how. Napa know-how.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, the trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with seven best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.